this? What's your operating number?
Hello there. I'm Danny Schaefer, lead game designer for Star Wars Unlimited.
Hello there.
General Kenobi.
Hello there, indeed. This is Flank. I've got Danny Schaefer, the lead game designer over at FFG, responsible for all of those Star Wars Unlimited cards that you've been hoarding, you goblins. So, Danny, big congratulations first and foremost here, mainly because the game has essentially just fired out of the gate at full gallop here. You must be feeling good about that.
Yeah, we're feeling great, and thank you. It's so weird after years of working on the game to finally be at a spot where it's out there in the real world, where people are playing with it, and where honestly the response has been like as good as we could have imagined. It's so exciting.
So that's a very fascinating question, and regarding, like you said, just finally seeing it come to fruition where people can get their their grubby little hands on it. Well, we're going to touch on that a little bit. I want to get first the Danny Schaefer origin story when it comes to card games. I started way back when as a 12-year-old, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, getting Star Wars CCG by Decipher, and then it was all downhill from there. That was like 26 or 27 years ago.
Yeah.
Where does the Danny Schaefer story arc begin when it comes to card gaming?
Yeah, so it definitely starts as a kid. Probably, God, I don't even know how old I would have been when I started playing card games. My parents loved all the like kind of classic card games and board games. And I first got into Pokemon when I was, God, it must have been like eight, maybe seven or eight, pretty young. And was one of the probably the few people in the world to actually learn to play the Pokemon game as opposed to just collect the cool cards. And then really I got more hooked on TCGs in college. That's when I got into Magic, started playing that a ton for several years, was really into Magic. And from there, that kind of led me to Fantasy Flight, where I started 9 years ago now, and have worked on card games pretty much continuously since then, from Game of Thrones to Warhammer Conquest, Arkham Horror, and most recently Keyforge before Unlimited. So Yeah, a lot of card games in my past.
A random tangent that's sort of where we intersect on this, frankly, is the fact that you mentioned Game of Thrones, and I've never played Game of Thrones, but I did once upon a moon do some content or with a gentleman by the name of Joe Mirando, who was a former Game of Thrones world champion, if I'm not mistaken.
That is true. Yeah, yeah. I remember him winning Worlds 1 year.
I don't know what happened to him. Honestly, the guy one day, he was a Gwent player for a while, was a fairly popular streamer, and then one day just decided to, God knows what happened to him. He disappeared. I hope he's doing well, but it's just funny when you talk about what Game of Thrones and sort of that lead up to where we are now, which is for Star Wars Unlimited, and you mentioned saying, hey, it feels good to finally see it, you know, published, see it released. Mm-hmm. When was that first birth of the idea, and who would you say is that patient zero of the origin of Star Wars Unlimited?
So yeah, I think the story of Star Wars Unlimited for me, I guess, really starts with me and Jim Cartwright, who is now our I don't know what his title, you know, executive VP of strategy or something, but at the time was working with me in the card game department. And we had been we had talked a lot about, you know, with knowing the end of Destiny had come, about what we would do with a new Star Wars card game, what direction we would take it, what the kind of core of that game would be. And I think it was in the summer of 2020 that we officially started the process, put together a pitch, and really started rolling on the development of what would eventually become Star Wars Unlimited. So yeah, really, it's me and it's Jim who were there from the very, very start.
Well, the process of what that initial concept was to where we are today, like if you were to kind of, would you call this game like a glow up from that first initial bubbling idea to where we are now? What is it, like, how different does it look?
I will say we had an R&D process at the start. We were trying just various different mechanics and systems and, almost completely different. I was the one mechanical thing that has been there from the very beginning is building around the one leader. You have a one character who you're building your deck around. That character is going to have dictate what cards go in your deck, and also is going to have an ability that really shapes your deck. That's probably the most constant from where we started. It was, you know, fairly early to get some of the other systems as far as, you know, building up resources throughout the game as far as space and ground arenas. But the variations on exactly how that worked were pretty extreme, especially in the early days.
One of the greatest quotes that I love to mention, especially when it comes to design processes, is the fact that it's attributed, ultimately, the person who said it was Leonardo da Vinci, but who echoed it many years later was George Lucas. So I'm going to attribute it. It's kind of like the Michael Scott, Wayne Gretzky kind of quote of a quote thing. But the quote is that art is never finished. It is merely abandoned. And I feel like to a certain degree, there has to be a point where you may have seen that there was you know, maybe other avenues to explore within the game's design, or maybe, you know, we could always add this, or maybe we kind of flower out or feather out this aspect. But do you feel like there were parts of the game that you had to put on the back burner and explore later or expand upon later when you, you know, push the print button on this game?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are still things that we haven't even come back to exploring that every so often I'll wake up in the middle of the night and be like, oh, that mechanic, that would have been really cool. We'll have to go back to that someday. But yeah, there were, I think, several things that were talked about or even were present in set one early on that eventually we said, we're going for, you know, we want this game to be sort of built around the fundamental structure right at the start. We want this game to be accessible. We want to not overload people in the very first set. So there are certainly things that we held back for future sets. Some of which we're still holding back even 9 sets into design, but some of which you'll see coming in even in the first, you know, 3 or 4 sets of the game. Things we talked about putting in set one and then said, maybe we'll hold that back and it'll be a cool thing in set 3 or set 4 or set 5.
What's fun about doing these interviews is that I understand the limitation that you may have regarding what you can actually tell us. But every now and then, I like to go in there and just reach and pick out a little something that you said and just sort of get a little greedy with that information. You're mentioning that you said set 9. And this is something that I spoke to Tyler about, because Tyler was talking about things like, you know, the same concept of, you know, down the line, down the line, down the line. And part of it is just instilling the confidence within us, the player, that this is something that you guys have invested in. And again, I've said that I've been lucky enough to be at the Celebration event in Minneapolis where these conversations were had, where you guys were talking about, you know, 2026, 2027. Set 9 is, I mean, we just got spoiled a bunch of stuff from set 2 and we're already over the moon, and it's already done enough for a lot of people to say, we're buying in, we're all over this. Set 9 for you, is that, you know, like, is that a Q2, Q3 kind of 2027 move? Are you guys playing 4D chess that far ahead?
We are very far ahead. Set 9 is going to take us to basically through 3 years of the game's life. And again, we're early on set 9. We've just sort of started scratching the surface of what it's about. But yeah, we're well aware, I think, that committing to this game and showing people our commitment to this game is super important. And I think just being that far ahead and letting people know that we have stuff planned for 2, 3, even more years down the line is a big part of that.
So I want to ask you this, because you said there's so many ideas that are kind of even keeping you up at night to a certain degree, but there has to have been a point in the design process where you guys were close, but maybe not yet, not there. But at one point, something clicks, the light comes on one part of the design process where you said, this is it. We crossed the finish line for the product. Do you remember if that moment existed? Was there one specific, you know, Rubicon you guys crossed that said, we're there?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think to your point, the game never feels totally complete, right? It always feels like there's more to add, that there's more going on. But there have definitely been a few moments where it's like, oh, that was a big moment. It feels like this is a game now. One that I always talk about with Jim is when we hit on the idea of aspects and the fact that, like, some would come from your leader and some would come from your base, and the way that shaped the whole structure of what the card pool looks like, what decks look like, what constructed and limited play look like. When that clicked into place and we did our first few tests building decks and playing with that, it was definitely a moment where it felt like, oh, this is probably the game. We're going to go with this.
That's good. That, I mean, it's a very innovative way to do things that does kind of, it feels inspired from other deck building, you know, structures of the past, but feels good. It feels clean. It also leaves a lot of latitude for deck building and innovation, which is great. Yeah. And I think that that's kind of what you guys were looking for. And part of this is limited, and it's a big conversation currently. I mean, I'm very well ingrained in the Flesh and Blood culture and their competitive. And I just did an episode with some world, like national champions, about the importance of limited from a competitive standpoint. When you're designing this game, how much of the design space was pushed towards saying, we need to have a game that is equally as intriguing and satisfying from a constructed standpoint as it is from a limited standpoint?
Really important. I'm realizing now, I said the leaders were probably the one thing from the very first vision that stayed consistent, but actually another thing that was in that very first pitch that we've said from the very beginning is we wanted this to be a game that you could play constructed, draft and sealed, and multiplayer, and for it to feel robust and interesting and fun in all those formats. So yeah, from the very beginning, we were designing the system, designing the deck building with the idea of, let's make sure this is a good experience in limited, that, you know, we're designing the aspects, the deck building, everything, such that when you draft it, you have compelling decisions to make. You can be reading signals. You can be going in different directions, depending on what the packs give you, in a way that, yeah, feels fun and rewarding and familiar to people who have drafted other games, but also with some new twists, you know, particularly with like the leaders and bases and those combinations and how those, especially the leaders, really affect your draft direction.
Star Wars U feels like I wouldn't say an homage necessarily, but an evolution upon its ancestry in the TCG space. And I know that within the design room, there's a lot of players like yourself, like Tyler, who have so much experience with other card games. And there's a lot of familiarity. And be it through keywords or basic mechanics of unit combat and trading, etc. What was the approach when it came to designing this game from the angle of, you know, looking at your heritage of card gaming? What, you know, keeping what works and sort of shaving away the dangly bits that don't do anything, you know?
That's a really good way to put it, actually. Yeah, it was about looking at the past, looking at the numerous other games we have experience with, identifying the things that people like, that people will find familiar if they've played other games in the past, that people will pick up quickly if they haven't played those other games, and sort of honing in on those best elements, you know, coming up with some new twists, some new systems, in a way that, yeah, could make the game still feel fresh, interesting, new, but still, yeah, very accessible, still very, like, just clean, solid gameplay without the extraneous stuff that can kind of distract or get in the way. I think it's clear. We've learned a lot from a lot of past games, but put some new twists on it, or even just combine things in ways that are different. You know, the combat, I think, is familiar to some other games, but combining it with the back and forth actions puts a really different twist on it than in a, you know, I do all my combat, you do all your combat system, things like that.
Yeah, no, definitely. It always seems like whenever a new card game comes in, it always just seems like some of it are just taking, marginal improvements on the past, but a lot of them feel like clones of the past. I feel like Star Wars U is something that is very unique in terms of you feel like you're in a familiar place, but it's all new to you.
Yeah.
It's a series of odd kind of deja vu to a degree, but a good sense of like a nostalgic deja vu where you're experiencing something for the first time, but you don't necessarily feel like everything's foreign to you. It's a very interesting balance that has come with this game that I think you guys have pulled off exceptionally well. And
thank you.
It's great. A big part of this, though, is going to be keywords, because there were so many of them, obviously, that have released early on. I know that one of the questions that we fielded from the Ice Cave viewers is one basically regarding keywords, and I'll get to that question in a second, but I have to ask you first and foremost is that how careful are you about future keywords? Because there are some from that, you know, may seem familiar from other games that they might just be complete, you know, grenades tossed in the room when it comes to Star Wars.
Yeah, it's definitely something that we found is we honestly, like, especially in, even in set one, we tried, you know, what seemed like natural keywords from other games, ported into Unlimited, and realized that they play very differently. The mechanic where the shoot first mechanic, basically, we tried that as a keyword on that was on a bunch of units, and what we realized is when you're playing a unit and your opponent can immediately directly attack it and take no damage back, it doesn't feel good if there's a lot of that floating around the game. It's fine if it's like a one-off on an event or an expensive unit like Han Solo, but if it's everywhere, it's just like, oh no, suddenly like my action is do a thing, my opponent's action is completely obliterate that thing. On the flip side, like especially in future sets, we found more and more a lot of cool space where we can dig into keywords that couldn't exist in other games, or at least not in the same way, that really lean into what makes Unlimited special. I can't give too much away, unfortunately, because it's future stuff, but you know, you can think about the specific things that are unique to Unlimited, or that Unlimited has versus other games, and ways we could dig into those more in ways that other games couldn't. But yeah, it's really exciting when we find stuff like that where it's like, oh, here's a new keyword that is very Unlimited specific. Yeah, it's exciting.
For those of you who are watching this or listening to this, I promise you that I do my best to shake the coconut tree as best as I can without getting donked on the head. So there is a follow-up question specifically to to the keyword question, and this one from T-Bird off of the off of our Discord server, and basically saying, is there going to be support for existing keywords way down the line? And the example given here is something along the lines of like, hey, if we get Bounty, are we, you know, in set two that has just been announced, are we gonna get is that it? Is it a one and done for set two, or will there be Bounty appearing in set five and set eight or something along those lines?
Yeah, so it's another spot where I can't get into specifics, but I can say in general, it's going to vary a bit from keyword to keyword. I think it's probably already clear that the set one keywords, Ray and Restore and Sentinel and Ambush, those are going to be in every set and have support throughout. For the new keywords that we introduce in new sets, some of them are going to show up very often. You know, they'll show up again in another set, just maybe in the next set or a couple sets down the road. Some of them will be more specific to one set, but that doesn't mean we can't go back to it, you know, five sets down the line. It's like, oh, that here's the mechanic from set two. It'll be back in set seven. I think that is on the table for basically any new keyword we do. So it'll vary from keyword to keyword, but expect some possibility of going back to them. And some of them we might go back to really soon.
One of the most difficult things to balance is not necessarily just about power level and power creep related questions, but it's more so about fun versus functional, casual versus competitive. Sure. And I have been very supportive of this game from the aspect of you can have fun without playing from the optimal perspective. You can do cool things and have a good time. I'm asking you about the design process of this game to have an equal amount of appeal for casual, cool, fun things to do. And obviously with Twin Suns and things like that, and obviously the fact that it's Star Wars, you're going to appeal to people who just want to have fun. But it's a very big driving force for other card games to have that appeal. Kitchen table style things or formats that don't have prizes at the end, that don't necessarily reward anybody outside of, you know, just bragging rights. In the design room, how much focus is given to just saying, let's make a really cool card, or let's make a card that's not going to win games, but it's going to create really funky scenarios?
Yeah, it's a big topic in the design conversations, probably more so than any other card game that I've worked on before. It's just identifying that this is a TCG. We're going to make a ton of cards, and there's going to be a ton of different audiences playing, as you say, different formats, casual, competitive, Twin Suns, draft and sealed. And not every card has to be for the competitive player, which is honestly a bit of a mindset shift from some of our past games that I've worked on. But I think it's really cool and exciting. We really do intentionally go into conversations on design on each set, looking at cards and identifying, okay, these cards are going to be competitive cards. We have to balance them and design them and develop them around the idea of we'll see these in competitive play. But there's also big chunks of cards where it's like, okay, this card is, these cards are just to be exciting to the casual player. It's okay if this card isn't, you know, as consistent or doesn't show up all the time, you know, in Constructed. It's okay if this card is much better in Twin Suns because it's a multiplayer ability. It's okay if this card is a build around in Draft that maybe doesn't make the leap to Constructed. So yeah, we talk about that all the time. And it's, and honestly, it feels like it just creates a lot more possibilities when you're not trying to pigeonhole everything into it has to be on a very flat band of competitive power level.
The approach towards Twin Suns, and you know, yeah. I know that the design team, myself, a lot of people within the community are going to have a lot of fun playing games like Commander from Magic and Twin Suns as being a multiplayer format. What do you like? Where was the birthplace of Twin Suns? Was it something that as a design team you guys identified early as we need a multiplayer format? Or how late in the design process for Star Wars U was the concept of Twin Suns introduced?
So it's another thing that from the start we said we want a multiplayer format. And we were, again, early on we were mostly focusing on one-on-one, but pretty early in the process we started testing multiplayer, different variations on it. The actual innovation that Twin Suns is two leaders together was a bit later in the process. We were pretty well along on developing the, you know, Draft and Sealed and developing 1v1 Constructed when we got to that conclusion of, oh yeah, two leaders. That's cool. That's really different. It opens up deck building possibilities in a cool way. And once we got there, that was another moment where like things just clicked into place where it's like, oh, this feels different. It's not just I'm playing the same game but multiplayer. It's I'm probably building a totally different deck, especially as we get more cards in the card pool, where I'm really focused around how does this leader ability work with this other leader ability. Again, multiplayer was in there from the start. The idea of, oh, combine leaders, expand deck building options that way was partway through the process, a little later along. But when we got there, we realized pretty quickly that it was a really cool way to go.
For future, you know, be it card design or even product diversification, is Twin Sun something that is going to be, you know, directly tackled as a format that you guys are going to develop and support and say like, okay, this is a Twin Sun card or this is a design that we're doing because we want it to affect multiple players. But at the same time, and when I say product diversification, I mean, you can completely just brush off this question, but are Twin Sun precons something that we might see down the line?
I will have to brush off the specific product question.
I thought so. Yeah, that was a throw in, and it's all good. I respect that.
Yeah. But yeah, to your question about design, like we do in pretty much every set have a certain number of cards that we look at and say, oh, this is a card for Twin Suns or a card that at least will shine in Twin Suns. We're again not trying to design cards that only work in Twin Suns, but cards where it's like, oh, clearly that, you know, this affects each opponent or this, you know, plays my opponents off each other in a way that is cool in multiplayer specifically. Yeah, we definitely look at that.
In which case, I'm going to ask you this then, you know, Twin Suns as a format, it's obviously going to be labeled as a kitchen table kind of let's have some fun, but similar type of multiplayer formats have evolved to have competitive scenes, to actually even have competitive tournaments that bubble up, be it at like SCG cons or things like that. Are you going to be supporting Twin Suns purely from a casual perspective? Are you going to sort of try to pump the tires on it to be like, hey, this can be competitive. There is something here for the competitive crew.
I would say our intention has been to treat Twin Suns not as a competitive format, to say this is the multiplayer, more casual side of things. Premier is the competitive. Premier and honestly, Draft are the more competitive side, or where we'll put those, you know, competitive tournaments. With that said, I mean, we're always, you're trying to watch the community and be receptive to what's going on out there. So if there's a significant interest in it, we could revisit that for sure.
So I had this conversation with Tyler, and it was probably the biggest hurdle I would imagine that FFG had to overcome beyond obviously making a good game. And it's that there is this turbulent past when it comes to supporting card games from, you know, beyond a certain point. This is something that y'all have not shied away from, those discussions, and I really respect that. But I said this to Tyler, and it's probably true for many people who are listening to this, is that when it came down to Star Wars U, I know I was bought in from the get-go, but a lot of people that I know were not, and that includes LGS owners that I'm friends with, and it was a hard sell. And they said, even you, Flake, we're not going to carry it even for you. But eventually they came around.
Yeah.
Do you feel that this was probably your biggest hurdle at FFG for creating a good game, despite the fact that you all were very confident that you've created something special here? There's mm-hmm. got to be this brick wall that you understood that, hey, we need to just, you know, tuck our head down and just barrel through this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's another thing that almost from the very start of developing the game, part of our conversations were, we're going to have to win back some trust. Like, people, there's a perception out there. People know what has happened to past card games from FFG. And we obviously realized that ignoring it wouldn't do us any good, that would just be more of the same, that we had to acknowledge it, confront it head on, and also, like, show people that we're doing things differently, show people that we are, you know, committed to this game several years out in terms of design and development, that we're going to have the support for organized play, that we're going to be open and responsive and communicating with the fans. We're not just going to be, you know, a brick wall or anything like that. It's been part of, again, the conversation from the start, and we're hoping we can carry that forward and keep, you know, being open, keep showing people that, no, we really are truly committed to this game. This is special. This is different. This is not the same old FFG.
This is a difficult conversation, obviously. I mean, it's not a happy one to, but it's in the past. And that's something that you have to look forward, and it just gets frustrating mm-hmm. for everybody involved. And I get asked this probably about a dozen times a week of, yeah, but how do you think it will last? And without giving away too much to these people, I say, listen, I've had conversations that this is something wherein I'm already making plans for this game into 2027. And you know what? At the end of the day, how far into the future do you want to think about these things? But I think that FFG, that you all at Star Wars U have done a really good job of, I think, approaching this the right way, which is, we're not going to like sweep it under the rug, but we're going to lead with a good product and a very collectible product, a very desired product, and go from there. So you've done that, and this product is just flying off the shelf now. I think that the first wave of it, I think, is done and dusted. Everybody is still wanting to rip packs. I am probably one of the people out there. I enjoy ripping packs like everybody else, but I'm also the type where I understand once I have what I need, I can pretty much kind of tame that beast. But there's this urge inside of me at all times to just tear open absolutely everything Star Wars related, because it's such a fun experience. So before we get into the collectability conversation, I want to ask you if the success of Star Wars U has fallen short, met, or exceeded your anticipation from release?
It certainly hasn't fallen short. I think it has exceeded pretty much all our expectations. I think some of us, you know, myself and Jim Cartwright included, had like a hope that it could be this big or you know, on this level. But it's one of those things where you can never quite allow yourself to think that's actually what's going to happen. There's always that fear of like, let's be realistic. It's not going to just like sell out like crazy immediately, you know? To see the response, to see it, as you said, flying off the shelves, has been really exciting. Really just, there's nothing like it. It feels really great.
Well, the success has been great. And again, you kind of want to keep your expectations at least tempered a little bit, because disappointment is a tough pill to swallow.
Exactly.
But it has been a commercial success. It's been a critical mm-hmm. success as well. Mm-hmm. Those are two major factors to going back to what we said about earning that trust back from not just the player base, but from the retailer side as well. I don't know if you're privy to this information or whatnot, but have you seen a spike in interest across the board from a retailer perspective after sort of like that first pre-release weekend?
I'm not as directly plugged into that on the design side, but my impression from people who are is that it's been a really positive response and increase in interest after the initial hype. that first week.
I love it. I love it. I mean, that, and the question now is, how do you sustain it? What is the strategy here to sort of continuously ride this wave? It has been this maelstrom of success, of critical acclaim, but, you know, at a certain point, that honeymoon phase kind of wears off.
Yeah.
So how do you insulate against that eventual kind of come down?
Sure. Yeah. I think the key really for us is just keep focusing on what's made us made it successful so far. Keep, you know, stick to the fundamentals of good game design that are there, while also, you know, continuing every set, push new exciting things, push innovation, push stuff that'll make people say, wow, this set is it's still Star Wars Unlimited, but it's different. There's something cool here to latch onto. And it also comes down to, you know, again, the stuff we talked about with being open with the community, supporting organized play, supporting the community, and being willing to adapt and improve things when we see things that aren't working as well as we like to.
The best selling point, I think, for players getting into particular games is, you know, a good rule set. But what keeps them there and keeps them coming back is not just innovation, but a solid approach to balance. And this is this basically, you know, it sink or swims when it comes to card gaming, is when you kind of attack things either too frequently, not frequently enough, or print this recipe for power creep that can be insatiable at a certain degree. Do you have a basic philosophy, or what is the philosophy, I'll say, from FFG when it comes to the balance of Star Wars U?
Yeah, there's a few different elements there. I think the biggest one is, we want to avoid power creep, certainly general power creep for the game. We want every set to open up new options that are still powerful and they can compete with existing decks, but not in a way that's just like, oh, this new deck is flat out better than the last one. We've been having a ton of conversations around this, especially in sets 4 and 5, but even before that, we were talking about a lot of let's print cards that are on par with some of the best cards from set 1, but that, or set 2 or set 3 or whatever, but aren't exceeding them, and that are just more asking you to build a different kind of deck, keep the metagame fresh in a way that doesn't feel like we just power creeped out the old stuff. So that's a big part of it for sure. And then obviously we're watching the metagame. We're seeing what happens. We're gonna be looking at it if things, you know, get stagnant or if certain things look too strong, and you know, we'll take action if necessary at a certain point.
Well, that's the next question, is how involved does FFG want to be into here? There's a lot of, you know, people clamoring for this is too strong, or that's too weak, or this leader needs to sort of have its wings clipped a bit. You know, some of the most egregious of conversation gatherers here would be something like Overwhelming Barrage. And it's like, how does this card get printed? Well, it's a strong card and it requires certain elements on the board, certain circumstances, but I've you know, being in card gaming for 25-26 years, I've heard every conversation, be it well adjusted and reasonable to absolutely unhinged. How when it comes to, I suppose, you know, you're saying keeping an eye on the meta, how aggressive does FFG want to be when it comes to bans, or dare I say, you know, erratas and such?
Sure. Yeah, we how aggressive is an interesting question. We definitely don't want to like jump in too quickly. We want to give, you know, especially when new sets come out, when they're fresh, some time for the metagame to shake out and people to make adjustments. But with that said, I think we're definitely willing to ban or make whatever kind of changes if we, you know, see a pattern where it's like, oh yeah, clearly this has been dominant for a while. It's too good. The game will be better if this is out of the meta. Yeah, so I guess medium aggressive, not just like immediate, like come down on the thing that's did the best this weekend, but I don't think we're just going to sit back and let things ride for months at a time if it becomes clear that there's an issue out there.
I wouldn't be a responsible journalist or pretend to be one if I didn't ask you if there were any cards that were particularly sort of buzzing around the radar currently as something to keep an eye on.
I mean, I think it's the ones you'd expect, the cards that show up everywhere. You mentioned Overwhelming Barrage. That's a strong card. We're obviously aware that like Energy Conversion Lab and Boba Fett Leader are everywhere, and about the powerful cards in those decks. So yeah, we talk about a lot of cards. Yeah, I don't think I can go too more specific than that. But yeah, yeah. I think you know the ones that we probably talk about the most.
I just that's the thing, and it's just,
well, and honestly, like cards that it's interesting in that there's this sort of delay between when we finalize set one and when set one hits the public. Where in the interim there, we're like, oh, we've been playing a lot of set two and three. You know, are these cards better than we thought they were when we locked in set one?
Oh,
yeah,
they
probably are. So we've been talking for quite a while.
This is my favorite kind of just sort of pull the curtain back on people who like to complain about things, is that when something is strong and it isn't immediately addressed in the next set, what I have to explain to people is like, when set one is printed, they are already thinking, they're already putting, you know, the final touches on set four or five to hit the printer.
Yeah.
Like set two is done and dusted. It's already printed. Set three is in the print, you know, in the print queue. Like there's only a certain amount. Can I ask you if you can maybe pull the curtain back? So what sets are basically getting the final touches? For example, we're in set one. Set two is starting to get the spoiler train going.
Yep. So obviously that's done.
That's done. I would imagine that set three is already done and like all the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted. What is this next? Like, how far into the future are you guys still turning the knobs and sort of, you know, dialing things in correctly?
Yeah, so yeah, as you said, obviously set two, we're spoiling right now, so that's completely done. Sets three and four, also done. Set five is the current set that we are testing and developing, and it, like, we can still make balance changes on. I mean, we haven't, I guess, printed set four yet, so we could, you know, last minute change something if we caught it, but for all intents and purposes, set four is done as well.
That's
so
fair.
We're really far ahead.
Oh no! Listen, this is an informative, journalistic approach, okay, to conversation about Star Wars. I want people to understand that you cannot expect answers for today to occur in the next set, but we leave the creativity of the deck builders to solve the problems that are out there. Is that so much to ask? Right? Like, you know, it's a fair question. I want to touch briefly, very, very delicately upon the concept of rotation and in the sphere of balance, I suppose. I don't know how often rotation will occur or when the first one is slated. However, will you be looking to perhaps allow something like rotation to solve the conundrum of power creep and balance?
Yeah. Yeah. So as you said, we are not talking yet about the pace of rotation or timing of rotation, but it is something we have planned. We've been designing and developing with rotation in mind. And to your point, it's a huge factor in allowing us to head off power creep, where we can keep the sets, as I said, at roughly the same overall power level, certain strategies pushed in one direction or another from set to set. While still letting the new sets be relevant, because at a certain point, set one will fall off, and you know, the early sets will fall off, and the new sets will have their time to shine. It's been a big conversation lately, actually, as we get deeper and deeper into design. We're talking about, oh, okay, like, how will rotation affect these sets way down the road? What will it mean when these, you know, 20 metagame defining cards from the early sets are no longer around? What fills their shoes? What cards get better or worse in their absence? It's something we think about a lot in competitive balancing, of course. And exactly as you said, it's a good way to not have to power creep with every set, right? To keep it relevant.
I mentioned earlier about this insatiable urge to rip packs, and I think that this is something that's shared by many in the community from a collector's standpoint. There's so many gems to unearth in a pack of Star Wars U, be it hyperspace foils, you know, hunting for those showcases, etc. You mentioned that, you know, your first foray into TCGs was just collecting all the cool cards from Pokemon, and I get it, because I was there. I was in that age, and part of it is just opening the shinies and the holos and just being like, okay, cool, like, it's fun to do that. It's the same experience with this. However, I want to ask you, in relation also to rotation, because this is going to factor into this question. The question is about reprints and the collectability versus accessibility question. It's hard to approach card games and card game design from at least for me, from the mindset of saying, how can this appeal to those who want to rip packs and put it in a vault, you know, like and treating it as a commodity. It's so foreign to me because I'm a card gamer and I love it, and it doesn't matter the condition of or the alternate art of the card, as long as it does what I want it to do, that's all I asked for. But there was a lot of people, there was a lot of chatter saying things like, well, I need Vader's, and Vader's most likely going to be a very strong card for a while because of what it does and the colors that it's associated with. What is the mentality of FFG when it comes to reprinting cards from a perspective of, you know, this card is coveted, it's hidden behind a pretty scarce rarity, we want people to have it? What is that mentality for FFG?
Yeah, so for sure our goal from the start, when we knew we were making a TCG, was to try and strike that balance between accessibility and collectability as well as we could, knowing that there are some people for whom, yeah, finding that chase card, finding that super rare version of a card is a big draw to opening packs, just inevitably. But also wanting the gameplay to be accessible to everyone. And it's something that we, as part of what we're doing, right, with the showcase versions of the hyperfoils, where the rarest, shiniest, most collectible versions of the cards are these cosmetic upgrades that are not, you know, they're not going to give you an advantage in the game compared to the regular version. Now, obviously, with the set flying off the shelves, as we saw, with the popularity being even more than we anticipated, there's currently a little bit of a scarcity of packs where you see cards like Vader and Boba being hard to come by for a lot of players, which is, it's unfortunate. We were hoping that we would have enough that it wouldn't be quite as hard to get those cards. But with that said, to your point about reprints, what can I say? We're not, I can't go into too much detail about, you know, obviously what we're thinking about as far as reprints. I can say that we are certainly willing to reprint cards and to reprint to help get cards into players' hands. The specifics of that I probably can't dive too much into, but reprinting is absolutely something that's on the table. And that, as you say, the most important thing, I think, is people who want to play the cards are able to get the cards.
Yeah, I tend to agree. People are going to look at me, and maybe it's a harsh way to say it, but I could not care less about somebody who is buying cards to throw them in a vault because they want to resell them later. Like, I understand that that's an aspect of TCG culture, but it's just, it doesn't speak to me. It doesn't speak to going and sitting at a table and playing the game, or determining a store champion, or down the line a galactic champion. Has nothing, doesn't sing to me in any way, but I understand.
Sure, yeah.
It's part of it. And
exactly.
Like, I'm sure that probably 20 to 25% of the sales were from people who are just ripping packs to put them in binders and, you know, maybe prospect a little. Again, there's no science behind that statistic, but I'm just saying. Danny, I got a few questions from the community, if you've got a couple more minutes, if you're down to sort of... All right, so this one from NTQ, from the Ice Cave Discord, asks, can you ask about how Bounty works on friendly units? There's a question, mainly revolving around, my boy Palpatine, that if you put a bounty on your own unit, you can kill it with Palpatine and collect the bounty. The wording doesn't seem to make sense on that, since you can't be the opponent to your own units. Can you offer a little clarity on a little friendly fire for bounty?
Yeah, so basically, you cannot collect a bounty on your own unit, is the simplest way to put it. If a bounty is on your unit, when that unit is defeated or captured, your opponent's going to collect the bounty, regardless of who put the bounty there or who did the defeating. You know, so if I have if I have a bounty on my unit, I'm not going to try to remember which set 2 bounty we spoiled off the top of my head. And I Palpatine defeat it, my opponent still gets the bounty.
Okay.
There's a little more going on in Twin Suns with multiple opponents that we'll get into as we explain the rules more. But
all right.
In general, you're never going to get the bounty for your own unit.
We almost had a little leak here. Now, this is not going to get published for probably another 5 days or so, but still, the fact remains, Danny, that you almost let one leak there. It's all good. One more question from Lefty. After hearing about how differently the public play the game versus how they initially played in testing, how has that impacted not only your initial testing, but card design in general. And as a kind of a follow-up, has there been any major oh-no moments where they've played with a card and realized how devastating a certain card would be on the meta? So I suppose seeing us play with your brainchild here, were there any moments where you're like, oh, wow, didn't expect that? like that's a little like a creative.
Yeah, moment. It's a really interesting question. There's a lot of layers to this because as I alluded to earlier, there's a big gap between, or maybe not a big gap, there's a gap between like how we were playing in set one only testing versus how the public is playing with it versus how we, going back to set one now knowing what we know, would have played it, right? Like so there is like I think like Boba and Sabine are good examples where, like, you know, in set one we knew like, oh yeah, these are good leaders. By the time we were developing set two or three, we were looking back and saying, ooh, Boba and Sabine are probably going to be really good in set one, like better than we thought at the time of set one. So there's, I guess, a degree to which our own play has also developed, and we've learned things about the game even before the public got their hands on it. But there are also, I think, clearly cards that we over or undervalued relative to like what's happening in the real world metagame. I think Tyler loves to bring up the Steadfast Battalion as a card that we were just like, yeah, this is a nice draft card, bonus for having a leader in play, and did not realize quite how potent that would be in Constructed, for sure. So yeah, it's definitely a complicated question as far as the way we play is always also evolving. We evolved from set one to set two to set three. We're learning more now, seeing how y'all are playing with set one. I think like Energy Conversion Lab is probably another good example of a card where we're like, oh yeah, this is a strong green base, strong pull towards green in set one. I don't think would have had it as high as it has played out in public. You know, it's been stronger than we thought. Well,
that's what we're here for, man.
Yeah, and then yeah, as far as like retroactive. Oh, we just realized something. Moments. I don't know if there's anything where we've quite had a like, oh no, we, you know, realize there's something in a past set that is gonna dominate the meta like two sets later. We've had more minor ones though, where it's like, oh, this combo existed in set two. We didn't really play with it much until set four. And it's like, it's pretty good. It's, you know, like probably, again, nothing that we've seen where it's like, oh, this is going to be dominant. We messed up. But definitely some things where it's like, oh, maybe we, you know, we should explore that more. That could be good.
Love it. There's so many things that are kind of swimming around in my brain in terms of like, this is going to be good. We're just waiting for the extra shoe to drop. That basically does it for a lot of the heavier stuff, Danny, and I really appreciate your transparency and how candid you are in terms of just engaging in a lot of these topics here. There is one more piece that Tyler Parrott now is probably going to take responsibility. We're calling it shoot from the hip. Are you down to shoot from the hip?
Sure, why not?
Okay, so part of this also is that Tyler, without any encouragement, did some finger guns like this, so you could either improve upon. There we go.
I hope you're still paying attention, because now I'm going to tell you the most important.
I can't improve upon Tyler's finger guns. Tyler is a maestro of finger guns.
So we're going to do a little shoot from the hip, and that is basically, we'll call a little rapid fire lightning round kind of stuff. You could be as elaborate or as short-winded as you wish, Danny. Are you ready to shoot from the hip, my friend?
Sure.
Let's do it. First question is, who has the wildest card design ideas in the room?
Wow. A lot of good candidates for this. I would say a lot of the newer designers have some wild ones. John Leo and MJ Cutts are the two that spring to mind. Is they'll design cards where I'm like, whoa, I didn't know the game could do that. Maybe it can't. So yeah, a tie between MJ and John, I think.
The maybe it can't part is a very fascinating part about this. Okay.
Yeah. Ryan Serrano is our sort of rules expert now, and is the one who most often has to come in on a card design and say, y'all, I wrote the rules. This doesn't work in the rules. It's not even close to working in the rules. We got to change this card.
I was about to ask, who, there's got to be a rules guru who essentially is like the gatekeeper for some of these more ambitious ideas, and I'm glad that someone's there to reel it in. Next question is, what card is currently being slept on?
I feel like the answer I always give for this is Millennium Falcon, just because it's just, it does it all. It's such a good card, and I really, yeah. If you're playing aggro, it's really good space aggro. If you're playing mid range, it defeats all the aggressive space units. I love Falcon. It's one of my favorites. There are other answers I could give, but I think they would give too much away about what's coming in future sets.
No problem. I love it. Danny, who inspires you?
Maybe just because you talked about Tyler, but Tyler definitely inspires me on the design team. Tyler is the one who's just like willing to, like, you know, grab an idea, just like the most creative idea, and be like, okay, but how can we actually make this work? And it definitely inspires me at work for sure.
Every team needs a Tyler.
Yeah.
Danny, what is your fast food guilty pleasure? You're driving home and you're like, don't feel like cooking. I'm just going to hit a drive through. What is that ideal place?
This is an easy one. I do a lot of Taco Bell. It's cheap. It's better than it should be for how cheap it is, in my opinion.
Yeah,
especially on the way to the office. Yeah, there's one like 2 blocks from the office now. I just hit it on the way to work like at least once a week.
I had some friends of mine from the States come by, and I had to warn them. I said, Canadian Taco Bell is not the same as American Taco Bell because we have slightly better food-related standards, so you're not going to get the same ingredients in it. And they were like, what is this? This barely feels like I'm eating junk food. I was like, I know. American Taco Bell.
I will say, I had a crazy experience when I went to my cousin's wedding in Toronto where I went to a Taco Bell, and they just had French fries. I was like, what? Fries?
Yeah,
this isn't right.
No, I trust me. They're like, would you like fries? I was like, where am I? Like, this should not. No, throw another taco in there. If there's room for fries, yeah. Like, get out of here with that garbage. All right, Tyler. So you're playing in a major event. Okay, there's spectators. You've got 42,000 raving fans. The lights go down. The match is occurring in the middle of a ring. Okay, what music is playing as you're walking down to the ring? What is your walkout music?
42,000 fans. I'm just gonna like mess with them and play some of like my like quiet indie folk music, like Boy Genius or Joanna Newsom or something like that, and make them listen to this quiet, sad folk song as I walk out to this packed arena. That's my plan, I think.
Hey, one of the biggest legends of wrestling is The Undertaker, and he came out to just a dong sound for like the whole time. There's like barely any music, that in organs. So I think that the ominous kind of, you're a killer. By the way, when I said 42,000 fans, it's because the other 150,000 fans are cheering Tyler on for this matchup.
That sounds like about the right ratio, yeah.
Yeah, but hey, you guys sold out a 200,000 place arena.
Not bad.
Yeah, once you factor in, I'm trying to do the math here, what is it, 18,000 or no, 8,000 media, that's where the 200,000 sort of clues in. That said, once this game is into its, you know, 50th year, and somebody, the Martin Scorsese III, says I'm gonna make a movie about this because it is such a cultural touchstone, who plays Danny Schaefer in the movie?
I always struggle with this question because I don't know. I don't know who what actor is most like me. Offhand, I'm going to say Nicholas Holt, just because I watched The Menu not too long ago. I loved it. He seems vaguely, you know, has the same like white guy with brown hair thing, and he could be goofy enough to be me. I think that would do it.
He was Beast. That's a pretty good
one. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, no arguments there. All right, so after you win that big match in front of 200,000 raving fans, right? And then you go after the fact and you go watch the movie. Now you're saying, hey, we got time left. It's only 11 o'clock. Let's go to karaoke. What's the first song you're punching into the karaoke machine?
So we actually have done some karaoke nights, the card game team and the events team with Xander. Last time we went, I did X's and O's by L. King.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Tyler said Backstreet Boys, and I was like, yes, Tyler, I will sing.
Tyler, I saw Tyler do Backstreet Boys. Tyler is actually good at singing. It seems like against the spirit of karaoke. But yeah, Tyler kills them on Backstreet Boys.
he's the person who shows up like that episode of Seinfeld where Kramer goes to the goes does karate against 12-year-olds. It's like it just seems unfair.
Yeah.
But still, the success rate is there. Yeah. Listen, next time I'm going to Minneapolis in June, okay? I'm staying there a
week. All right.
We are going to karaoke. I will show up at your doorstep and knock every single day until we go. That is a fait accompli. Last question for you. Actually, second to last question. There's a mystery one. It's not harmful at all. But we're going to go with original trilogy, prequels, or sequels.
This is a tough one for me. I think as much as I think the like three movies of the original trilogy are like the three best overall movies, I just love the prequels so much. Like the story arc, the characters, the memes, everything about it is just great. I love the prequels.
I was waiting for the memes to sort of get wedged in there. last one, totally scientific poll I've been conducting for quite a long time now. Skittles or M&M's?
Oh, Skittles.
Oh, Danny, you were on a roll, man. Like you were just crushing this entire conversation until the end. You saw the finish line, you tripped on a pebble, and then you lost it there, man. I don't know.
I guess maybe if it were peanut M&M's, you could sway me.
Oh, okay. So the first time I did this, I told Tyler, I said Skittles or peanut M&M's. He said, oh, you had me at M&M's until you said peanut. I said, okay, any variation of Skittle versus any variation of M&M that you want. Does this change your answer at all?
So it's sour Skittles versus peanut M&M's. Yeah, it does. Peanut M&M's win. The best kind of M&M.
The redemption arc. This is it, baby. Heck yeah. Nice. I love it. You just took Palpatine in the form of a big Skittle and threw him into the core of the Death Star. That is the end of the arc for you, Danny Schaefer. My man,
I am happy to go out that way.
That's a good way to go out. And I do sincerely appreciate, like I said, not just I want to congratulate you, obviously, for the success of this game, which has taken everybody by storm. It's not just a flash in the pan. I think that this game has a fundamental just structure to it that is just rock solid. And it's Star Wars and it's awesome. So congratulations on creating a phenomenal game.
Thank you so much. That means a ton to hear. I really appreciate it.
No worries, my friend. You can thank me when we go karaokeing. And on that note, friends, thank you very much again for tuning in to this brand new project that we're doing here in the Ice Cave Network, which is Hello There. And every week, we're going to bring you somebody else from the community, the movers, the shakers, the needle movers. So Danny Schaefer, lead designer over at FFG for Star Wars U. Thank you so much. And we'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. Be kind. We'll see you next time on Hello There.
So uncivilized.